shall overcome.
Incredibly courageous for Bishop Derry to get up. I mean, we wouldn't have got up if he hadn't taken the lead.
It was total silence, a neary silence, and all I could hear was a woman behind a telephone box crying. That was my bloody Sunday.
We since discovered at least one MI5 agent who was in the bogside in the week before. What were you doing there? What did you report back to your superiors?
My family have been destroyed by bloody Sunday.
Well, of course, I've already made public my position in relation to this Widgery Tribunal. I don't regard it as an independent inquiry. It is not international. The accused is appointing the judge and jury in this particular case. And what I heard today only confirms me in my worst suspicions, because the terms of reference of this inquiry today, as revealed today, are an absolute insult, because they're so narrow that they're confined only to the events as they took place on the streets of Jerry during that hour and a half on that Sunday.
Is that not what you wanted?
They exclude absolutely any investigation of whether there was a military plan for this thing to happen, of whether there was a political decision for what happened in Derry. They exclude, therefore, investigating the higher-up people, either in the military or in politics, who were responsible for the decision for the army to act as they did in Derry in that way. And that, to me, is completely unacceptable.
Would you be advising the relatives, therefore, not to take part in this inquiry?
Well, as I say, I've made my position public and clear. The relatives are very well aware of my views in detail, and they also have appointed their own legal advisers, and as their legal adviser pointed out today, they will take the decision now in the light of whatever report he has to give back to them.
In the days after Bloody Sunday, there was an appeal out for people that would like to give evidence and writing so that it could be presented to the world press. And I went to a school up in Craigan, and there were people there taking evidence, taking your statements. And after that, some time before then, they called the Widgery Inquiry. The British government set it up. I wasn't asked to give evidence, but Dr. Swords was. And he waited a few days and realised that it was pretty one-sided, and he didn't want to go. And he was in the City Hotel at that stage then. He was working down in the south of Ireland, and people involved came and asked me, would I go and talk to him? And I went and I said, look, Kevin, you're a doctor and you were there and you know the situation, particularly with the young boy, Donaghy. I said, you have to go and give evidence.
When I got the news that there was an inquiry and nobody had called me, they called other people, citizens of Derry, but not me. It was a witness, a rather important witness. So I asked them to call me and to receive me, let me speak, let me give my account. So in the end, they had to. Avoiding it would have been really demonstration of bias. Of bias against truth. Well, at the Widgery inquiry, I had a further confirmation of what I learned at looking at the screen of ITV and seeing Mr. Ford, General Ford, saying what he said, because it was so biased and so intimidating against people who, like me, were trying to simply say what they had seen, what they had photographed, what they had recorded.
I remember my mother saying this. They did. Would you inquire tonight? There were a woman shot. I remember that, you know. Because that time, they didn't take a statement off her at the time of the Widgery inquiry. But she don't know where a statement ever went or where none. That's really the only thing I remember about the Widgery inquiry. You know, just what my mother told us, things like that, you know. She said, I just can't believe. She says, they would deny me getting shot, and it was only one was shot. You know. She was devastated over that.
On the way to Culdane, I think, was the place where the hearing would take place. There was also a rather intimidating situation. because our car, this car, was followed by other cars. They came near us. They made signs, hostile signs against us from window to window, from car to car. It was rather intimidating, embarrassing. I said, the whole road to the place where the tribunal was holding its sittings.
Lord Widgery himself specifically drew attention to the narrowness of his terms of reference, the streets where the shooting actually occurred, and the time from the start of the procession in Derry to the time when the people were shot.
So I got there eventually, and I tried to start saying what I had seen. And this judge, Widgery, he decided from the beginning that I should only speak about the moment in which I, in that flat, on the first floor, in Rossville Flats, I was, somebody shot at the window, and I shouldn't say anything else. I said, yes, I tell you about that. But I want to say everything, whatever else I saw and witnessed, because I was there from the beginning to the end of the shooting. And so in the end, I was able to put in some evidence of what I had seen. And he was very hostile. He gave me an impression that he really didn't like me and what I was saying.
Those who feel that the tribunal may cast reflections on their conduct, they can, if they want, have legal representation. And on that basis, the army asked for and was granted legal representation. Then a lawyer representing 12 of the 13 families of the dead men stood up and said he might be asking for legal representation, but he would have to go back to the families first and ask. Lord Widgery replied that he'd very much like to see a legal team representing all those in Derry who were critical of the army. Mr. Kevin Agnew, the civil rights leader and a lawyer, said that he'd be representing the Northern Resistance Committee. He also protested at being searched on the way in. Mr. James Ray spoke from the public gallery. He's the father of the 13th dead man, and he said he would not be cooperating with the inquiry because he didn't believe it could be impartial.
The British government announced an inquiry on the, I think it was on the Monday, and the Widgery inquiry, as it turned out to be. Our family didn't take part in it, or went to Widgery, but told Widgery exactly that he didn't think he was fit or capable to be an independent judge when he was ex-military. As it turned out, my father was correct, because that was a bit of a sham.
The British authorities, British military spokespeople and top politicians, they were lying about it immediately. Brigadier, whatever he was, the main spokesperson for British Information Services, that's BIS, that's what they called themselves, Harry Dalzell Payne, was the main information guy there for the British Army in the north at the time. They had a statement out by, well, I think just after midnight, their statement came out and it was distributed, we discovered later, sort of to every consulate and every embassy sort of around the world, describing what had happened, wrongly or inaccurately lying about what had happened. So the cover-up began before the smoke had cleared from Rossville Street. So it wasn't a question of saying, you know, Widgery's good, they appointed Widgery to, or Widgery to find out the truth. We already knew they weren't telling the truth. The only question which remained was whether they were going to admit to the truth.
Unfortunately, the type of the inquiry, and Savile was something the same, you didn't have anybody to speak up for you. You just had to answer the questions from the government representatives and from the soldiers' solicitors. And you didn't have anybody, like in an ordinary court, to say, to cross-examine you, to tell your story correctly. And they brought up things, you know, that had nothing to do with a part of his personal life and nothing to do with what had happened on Bloody Sunday.
I don't even know to this day if my daddy ever went to Widgery Tribunal or took any part in it or not. But people, I think, at the time were naive enough to believe that the Widgery Tribunal would get to the truth of what happened.
And then the individual liars, like Soldier F. And every soldier gave evidence. Didn't give evidence. Because they were told not to give evidence. You forgot. You can't remember. It's a fudge. And from what I can recall, I was up in Coleraine, my brother James took me up to the Woodgery Tribunal, and I could see them coming in with their dark glasses, their berets, and that. There was no fear in them. Because we all know that was a whitewash, you know, right? You know, they give a wee bit of evidence, and as they went, and everything they said was believed. But you've what, 40, 50, 60 soldiers? You had thousands of people here on Bloody Sunday that told the truth and were denied justice.
Somebody in Derry, the people in Derry, had picked up the cartridges of this, of the bullets that had been shot. And this was a piece of evidence, clearly, very importantly, because it was proving that these cartridges belonged to these bullets that belonged to those rifles. So I had 90 cartridges in the bag. And I told Vigery, these are cartridges of the bullets of your army that shot at the protesters on that march. And I'd like to give them to you as a very important evidence. What did this man say, Lord Vigery, who should have immediately jumped on the occasion of having this piece of evidence, very important proof? He said, take them back with you. That's what he said.
It just doesn't add up what they're saying was true. You know, within, my brother never fired a gun in his life, never had a gun in his hand. You know, at the first inquest, the first whitewash would say that his right hand was heavily contaminated and his wee lead particles. Like he was left-handed.
See, I was still in hospital when the Woods inquiry was on, but I seen it, but said on TV. No. But it was a cover-up. Like a British army covered up. No. Lied and lied and lied. It took so many years for the Bloody Sunday inquiry. But you seen the lies that they told then?
Everybody realises now that the Widgery Tribunal was a whitewash, a total, total whitewash. We exonerated the soldiers and blamed the deceased and the injured for the reason for them all being gunned down that day.
I've no doubt in my mind about what happened that day. I still stand over everything I said that day and the day afterwards and successive days since then. I think that Lord Widgery disappointed me in his handling of the tribunal. I thought he was biased in many instances.
I'm not in the slightest surprised by the conclusions. They were what I expected them to be, a whitewash of the operation on January the 30th. And I think that within a very short time, when the independent press gets to work on what actually happened that day and examines Lord Widgery's conclusions, that he'll find himself a very embarrassed man. I think he should resign.
So it was so important for to carry on and get their names cleared once and for all. And we eventually, number one was the repudiation of Widgery, which we succeeded in doing, which we were quite proud of. Then they set up the second inquiry.
To me, it was very important for us to be seen along with John Hume. The people who died, what happened, Bloody Sunday happened under a civil rights banner. You know, you had to be very balanced here, would you? If you were serious about it, you had to be seriously balanced about it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you were going to go nowhere.
Yeah.
That's the way I seen it. And that's why we decided to leave your party politics outside, which we did. No, we held up rightly for a while.
Some of the things that we have done, and one of them I am particularly proud of, is the history of the campaign and the bringing together the families for the first time since 1972. And before that, there was really no sense of purpose.
But the minute we started the campaign, I was on it. We met for nearly 7 years, Tuesday night after Tuesday night. An inquiry to tell me what happened on Bloody Sunday. There's nobody in this town needed an inquiry to tell us. We knew. The British government needed it, and we forced them into it. They didn't come given this freely with a kind heart. They were forced into it. 3 days before Tony Blair made the announcement, the inquiry, they started destroying weapons. There was 800-900 photographs, police and army photographs, disappeared. There was an hour and a half of heli-tele footage, reduced to 3.5 minutes, and finishing before the shooting starts. And paratroopers lost their memory when they were given evidence.
We helped as much as we could to get people to come forward. And I realised that when people were given evidence at the Savile Inquiry, they weren't given evidence. They were actually, you could see them actually re-loving what was happening that day, because most of them, at some stages, you would have seen them actually ducking and hunching when they were actually speaking about what happened and what they were visualising. It was as if they were re-loving it again, you know.
Our goals were slightly different from the other families. They wanted their loved ones cleared. Because Johnny was cleared, the only one was cleared at Bordry, what else could he do? A 59-year-old man, like, he was the only one at Bordry, more or less, says wasn't a gunman. We had talked about over the years, we wanted the inquiry not just to clear their names, we wanted the inquiry to bring out what actually happened beforehand was the planning of Bloody Sunday, which went right down, went right to 10 Downing Street and went to the heart of Stormont with Faulkner and Tiller, with Ted Heath over in England, with Tussle and Ford, Tussle head of the British Army and Ford head of the Army in Northern Ireland. So we wanted that and didn't happen. We wanted the fact that a lot of the main shooters were SAS, didn't happen.
Myself and John Kelly spoke to a man in this town before the inquiry started. He said he got a phone call from somebody in London on the Tuesday, and the message went, the powers are coming in the Derry on Sunday and they're not coming in the Eel Battens.
They obviously had all the statements that people had made in the school in Craigan, and I was asked to go and to my solicitor and by a representative from the Savile Inquiry to go and make a statement. And then they were anxious to get Auntie Bridie's statement too, but by that time she was really quite old and would have been confused, so it wasn't to happen that she was fit to give the evidence. But I went to the Savile Inquiry, and I must say, there again, the soldiers' solicitors were quite rough on people, and they were innocent people, and they thought they were telling what they really saw and what they believed was to be the truth.
When she was shot after, when she went to hospital and told us that the soldier shot her, she says she was, give his description, everything. She says he cocked his rifle again, went to shoot her, and she says, please, I'm old, a woman with 14 children, please. Don't you, I mean, she says he just put his head down and walked away. But she gave a description of him. He had red hair. And when I went up to give me evidence then, and the inquiry started, and I went to England then when they were doing the paratroopers, and I went over especially to see him, the boy chap, my mother, and I went over, and Mickey Bradley got dressed, and he says to me, he says, hey, what colour's my hair? And I says, it's grey, Mickey. He says, what colour's my eyebrows? I says, they're still black. He said, well, just check it, I'm here. Because his hair might be grey, but check his eyebrows. And no, I still have the red hair, but it's grey. Right down to tea, my mother described him. She always says, like, I'd love to meet him and ask him why he shot me. You know, but she never did. It just gives any shot a gunman. And my mother, like, we had a coat on her before, you know, black stockings and high heeled shoes. You know. Suppose they didn't want to admit they shot a woman.
Yes, a testament to Savile Inquiry, yeah. Well, the Savile Inquiry was, the Guildhall, there were, say, four or five representing Emmons, representing the soldiers. I was only asked one question. That's all I was asked. So, you know what I mean? They were trying to cover up again there too, because they were only one soldier. If I was supposed to be a Neil Bomber, I should have been questioned a lot more. And once one question they asked me, and that was it. No, just that, how are you feeling today, Mr. Donegan? No, that kind of way. No. No. They never asked me, did I have a nail bomb or anything like that? No, that kind of way.
I went a few days to just be in the gallery watching, and I realized that it was one-sided in a sense, and that you would have to be very calm and know what your statement was from beginning to end and not let them try to divert you from what you knew was the truth. And I must say that was quite trying, but I was prepared. And the solicitor for the soldiers, like, he even, when I said that the young Donaghy's jeans were opened, he was making out that it was in the present, and I said, no, they were opened past tense. And he said, oh, I've been pedantic. Now, how many of those innocent people that was given evidence would even know what the word pedantic meant? And there was nobody to stand up for you. Your solicitor couldn't stand up for you and tell him to back off, in a sense, which you would do in an ordinary court. But anyway, thank God, in the end, it came out right.
And the way Mansfield put them right, he said, I'm going to put evidence to you. He said, I don't want you to say I don't know, can't remember. He said, just only put the evidence to you. From six witnesses. When Mansfield says them, you might be surprised, you know, the six witnesses I'm talking about are six soldiers, one of them an officer. And his fist changed. You know, when he heard it was actually soldiers' evidence that was going to be put to him. And so Mansfield put it to him, and eventually it actually says aye. And the shock and the gasp came out of just everybody when he admitted he shot Barney McGuigan. But, and he shot Paddy Doherty as well. It was put to him too. The evidence was phenomenal that it was him. He was the only, he knelt down when he shot people. And he knelt down when he shot Barney McGuigan, or Paddy first, and then Barney.
And that was called, and Susan, to Derry to give evidence, to give our testimony. There again, our pictures were shown. I commented upon the pictures. I explained what the various pictures meant, where they were taken, what I understood of them, and what I had experienced between one picture and the other, what the recordings meant, and so on. And it was taken. There was a rather professional, correct attitude on the part of the council, on the part of Lord Saville.
They shot Damien Donaghy at 10:04. Damien Donaghy and John Johnson at 4:10, and they moved on the Russell Street at 4:10. And according to Christopher Clark's analysis, Christopher Clark, who was counsel of the inquiry, he said from the first shot being fired when they moved on at 4:10, the last one being fired was 6.5 minutes and left 13 people dead. And probably, with the exception of Damien Donaghy and John Johnson, an hour, 13 wounded, 14 wounded, 6.5 minutes.
If you look at the questioning of British military intelligence officers, I guess that you look at the transcripts of them, questions and answers of it, and you'll see sort of that the military intelligence people, the MI5 people, were allowed by Saville to refuse to answer questions. You know, sort of people were warned, you'll go to jail if you don't answer questions and so on. I called David, MI5 officer, who gave evidence by video link to wherever he was. And I remember distinctly, it always struck me, that one of the lawyers for the families going through his evidence and asking him, he says, they're thinking about Aldous. And I went, what is Aldous? What does that refer to? And before he could answer, Saville jumped in. Well, Mr. Roxburgh, is that all right? He's the MI5. I asked the MI5 lawyer. And he said, just wait to check. He went down and checked MI5's lawyer and came back about 30 seconds later and says, no, he'd rather that didn't get out. And Saville then looked at the family's lawyer and says, well, there you are. We're going to have to leave it. That happened. At least a dozen occasions, MI5 officers were allowed to refuse to answer questions. Nobody else, even soldiers, thought it was allowed to do it. They may have lied, but at least the questions were put to them.
There's flaws in Saville, and he didn't go any further in Widgery. He stopped at Wolford. Doesn't go above there. I believe what happened on Bloody Sunday come from Whitehall.
the soldiers came in that day and murdered our relatives, and I think it was expedient to their political agenda that they thought that they could support maybe what I'd call an unjust government and system here in Northern Ireland by taming a lot of protesters or teaching them a lesson. And they've never learnt a lesson that when they killed my brother Jim that day, when they murdered Michael Kelly and Barney McGuigan, Jackie Duddy, Paddy Doherty, Kevin McElhoney, I could see all the names. They didn't solve a problem. They just created hundreds more enemies because they had fathers and brothers and sisters and grannies and uncles and aunts and friends and neighbours. And that's all they did.
The other thing politically that I think about Bloody Sunday, which I think isn't sufficiently acknowledged, for years, I took it for granted that what the British Army was doing was shoring up the Stormont regime, that the Raleigh's marches and the Faulkner's government was under pressure from Paisley and so on, and under pressure from the civil rights movement, and that the British government had sent the Paras in to teach the Bogside a lesson, and thus, you know, quieten things down, sort of. The more I've looked into it and talked to people, who were in government, sort of at Stormont at the time, I don't think that's true anymore. I don't think they were consulted at all. Maybe they approved of it in retrospect. Oh, the Brits did it on their own. There's no record that I know of, and I've talked to some of the people directly involved over the intervening years. There's no record of the Unionists going to the Brits and saying, do this. Now, they may have been happy that it was done afterwards, or they may have been content or think it was justified, but it is not true that Brian Faulkner and the Unionist Party contrived. As far as I can see, I know of no evidence that the Unionist Party was involved in this. This was a completely British atrocity. And the funny thing is, you get Unionists sort of taking responsibility for it. It's a good thing, you know, our soldiers did this. When you actually look at the record and look at the minutes of cabinet meetings and the minutes of the security committee of the Stormont government at the time, there's nothing in the days before it where they're saying this. You know, sort of they are calling in broad terms for crackdowns and all that. But you talk to the people involved to this day, and some of them still alive. You talk to them and say, tell us what you did. Did you ask them to do this? Did you tell them? Did they check with you if this was the way you should handle it? Well, they didn't.
No. But I've always felt that inquiry, the Savile inquiry, was actually made for the British establishment. They make themselves look not too bad, you know, and so that they could put the blame on what they called nine bad apples. That's what General Ford referred to them as, nine bad apples. But of course, we know that's not the case at all. I always believed they were sent and they were given orders. And that's, of course, why they won't prosecute these men. If these men were prosecuted, I mean, that would give them good reason then to speak up, tell the truth, and that they got orders.
Do you believe it, the paratroopers? Some paratroopers didn't follow orders. It's such a nonsense. The paratroopers are the best trained regiment in the British Army. And anybody that understands military affairs, and I'm not an expert on it, you don't need to be an expert on it, you know that soldiers don't disobey orders. The soldiers are disciplined. The paras were brought in on Bloody Sunday for a reason, because they were the most disciplined, the most aggressive troops on the day. And nearly 50 years, it'll be 50 years in 2 months' time, from the murder of my brother in 13 hours and the attempted murder of another 19, I think. And not only that, but the abuse of everybody was on that march that day.
The Paras, a posting before they came to Northern Ireland, was in Aden, you know, in the Yemen. So if I look back and look at Yemen now and try to trace it back, how did that happen? How is it such a broken place? Well, a whole number of reasons, but one of them is what the British did. For example, in the Crater District in Aden, which then became part of South Yemen, and now Yemen. They were out of there. You know, it's the same thing, massacring people in their own homes and so on. That leaves a terrible wound, sort of.
People that deal with things differently, I would say, I could never let it go. It annoyed me for my wife, God rest her, died saying that she always said, Leo, you have to let that go. You have to try and leave it. But I couldn't leave it because I thought justice would have been the only answer and a contentment for me.
The soldier A and B lied my day one about me and John Johnson and all the rest. The soldiers lied too. That, right, in 1970, on Bloody Sunday, they says I was a nail bomber. And I think it says Mr. Johnson was one too. Like, it was proved. Like, my clothes were took away when I was in the hospital and the thing made, and they proved there were no explosives on them or anything. And Mr. Johnson's was probably the same.
If you get all the documents from Bloody Sunday from the British Army, you know, and there's hundreds, maybe thousands of documents have been published. If you go through them, I was going through them and I noticed this funny thing on some of them, at the top of them, there was this in sort of stenciled, a big letters, perimeter. Perimeter. I wonder, what is perimeter? You know, and it's dead simple. I phoned somebody who said he had been a unionist. They said, what's perimeter? I said, oh, that. I said, that's what they wouldn't tell us. Perimeter meant don't show to anybody in Northern Ireland, including a unionist. This is for British eyes only. You know, now, why was that? Why was that? You know, it's you know, and if you listen carefully to what some of the unionists at Savile, I was struck by this, listening to some of the unionist politicians, and there was a note in some of their evidence of resentment against the fact that they were being asked to shoulder the blame, and they were in a dilemma because they approved the Bloody Sunday, mm-hmm. but they were being asked as if they had done it, and so forth. And there's if some of them would talk, even now, there's some of these guys still around. There's you know, sort of, it would be interesting, really, if some of them would go on the record. They won't. I've asked sort of former unionist ministers and so on.
In the last 2 years of it, I lost all heart in Savile. I knew it was going to be a whitewash as well, which it was. He gave the bare minimum. He cleared most people, bar leaving a slur in Gerard Donaghy's character, which was disgusting. The evidence was so phenomenal that young fella had no nail bombs on him until he got down to that army barracks underneath the bridge at Foyle Road. Even the soldier drove the car down, says he would not have got on that car if he had seen nail bombs in his pockets, because you couldn't have missed them if you were to look at the photographs. They're sticking out of his pockets, these big things. His trousers are open because they couldn't put the tight jeans. You could hardly get your hand into the pocket. They get a coin out, but they put a blast bomb or nail bomb. They just wouldn't have fit it. But even the medical officer in Foyle Road who checked him out for wounds and that says that he didn't see them. He says, he's showing the photograph, and he says, no, he says, if they had been there, he says, how could I have missed them? Because the weight of them, he says, you know, it's just how could I miss them?
When the eventual outcome of it came, it was such a consolation to know that finally, the lie, particularly pertaining to Jackie, as it was, the lie was to everyone and the rest of them, but for the Duddy family particularly, that lie that Jackie had been a petrol bomber, the soldier shot him, says he was about to fire a petrol bomb whenever he shot him. And for eventually for that lie to be declared that it was a lie, that Jackie wasn't guilty of doing anything whilst he was shot. There was no warning given from being shot. And eventually we got the truth that our Wayne, because that's all he was a 17-year-old Wayne. And they finally told the truth that he was innocent, he wasn't guilty of doing anything, and that he was shot for no reason whatsoever.
Military intelligence officers, there was Julian and David, and they were just allowed to sit there and say, we're not answering that. National security. Now, that has to come out. We've since discovered at least one MI5 agent who was in the Bogside in the week before Bloody Sunday. We know now, only discovered it a couple of years ago, that there's an MI5 officer in Derry, or if I had infiltrated the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, the group which actually organised the Bloody Sunday March. We haven't heard anything from him. What were you doing there? What did you report back to your superiors? to influence or to shape their thinking, which led to Bloody Sunday. We don't know that, and we don't know that because the Savile Inquiry blatantly refused to pursue those matters, anything to do with military intelligence. So we haven't got the truth. We haven't got the truth. The Brits are still hiding important aspects of the truth about Bloody Sunday.
We had the inquiry. We had the second inquiry. The second inquiry was completely unprecedented in British Irish history. And the inquiry, by and large, exonerated those that were murdered on the day and the wounded from being previously accused of being gunmen and bombers and petrol bombers and so on and so forth. So that was a big deal.
Savile left us learn that Jonathan's name, and strange enough, his sister Mary, who was very ill at the time the report came out, and Geraldine, her daughter, and Dennis McFeely, who was a great friend of Gerard's, was at the Guildhall. Mary was brought up then in a wheelchair, and I felt heartbroken for Mary being told that Gerard's name wasn't cleared. And on the last day of the inquiry, I was driving Mary home. We sat and we were finishing a cup of tea and we were chatting about it, and she says, "I'll sacrifice Gerard." That's not Mary, so the evidence is phenomenal. She says, "No, I'll sacrifice Gerard. I'm telling you now." She says, "I'll sacrifice Gerard."
And when I made my statement to the inquiry, the Savile Inquiry, my words were, "The soldier killed Michael, may as well kill my mother and father, because he never had a life that day." And I'm sure the likes of the Kayleys, and more so maybe men that died that left a wife and children. No, probably left me, nothing. Your husband, your son, was murderers.
What did you think of the people you were shooting at? Who do you think they were? I would love to know what kind of people they thought we were. And I don't.
Meeting up with Bishop Daly, coming out in the steps, and God love him, he was so relieved. He says, "Okay, they finally acknowledged the truth that we've been trying to tell them for all them years, you know." And he was so relieved about it all. And when he realised that we had the hanky with him, he was so emotional about it. Because what had happened was the hanky had been returned with Jackie's clothes from the hospital. And I don't know who washed it. You could have actually nearly seen like stains, blood stains still on it, but it was washed as good as it possibly could be, you know. And my daddy had it up until he died in 1985, and then I took sole possession of it. And I carried it with me throughout when we were travelling both to the Guildhall and then over to London, remembering that we had to travel to London for 13 months over and back all the time to the inquiry in London, you know. And it was like my comfort blanket then.
The inquiry invited relatives to come to view photographs they had to see if they could identify any of their relatives, because there was numerous photographs. And we were fortunate enough to find the photograph. And it's a photograph of treasure. Unfortunately, my mother's not in the frame, but it's quite clear. You see Jim, my dad, my younger brother Alex, and my younger sister, who was only about 12 at the time, all together in the group on that march that day. As I'm saying, we went out as a family group. We were out a family group, but we came home with one less of a family.
And I was working for Radio Foyle along with Bishop Daly in a building in the Guildhall Square when David Cameron came on the television, and we were overlooking the Guildhall Square, watching the people and the reaction and watching the families coming out. And it was one of the proudest days of my life that the truth had come out. Unfortunately, not totally for the young boy Donaghy, and I dispute it to this day that young boy had nail bombs in his pockets. And I also can't never understand why the soldiers that stopped him on the lower deck of the bridge weren't asked to give evidence about what condition he was in when he was in the back of the car. They let that boy die in the back of the car and then planted the nail bombs. As far as I'm concerned, that's the truth.
So I'd love to when they say this on the stage, but I didn't even know it was going to be talk. The only reason I think it was a big talk was I seen John Kelly read out Leo Young's. So I thought to myself, if I can't do it, I'll hand it to John. But I just read out what was on the sheet. I would like to have said about the inquiry not going high enough, that the staff, it was a complete whitewash.
I never expected anybody to actually suffer any penalty for it. I really didn't, because I think the government had invested so much time and effort into making sure that never had. The extraordinary thing I say about the Savile Tribunal, the Savile Tribunal was very good, it was excellent. But do you know something? The Savile Tribunal didn't find out anything new that lots of people in Derry knew from the day after. There was not, and the other extraordinary thing about Bloody Sunday is that you have to remember that it didn't happen off in a jungle in Malaya or Kenya or something like that, or South America. It happened in the streets of an ordinary city in broad daylight in front of hundreds, possibly even 1,000-odd witnesses. You know, it wasn't concealed or hidden or anything. Everybody saw what happened. Everybody knew what happened. Savile formalised that process, but Savile didn't really, as far as we are concerned, Savile didn't really find out anything new.
When the new inquiry, the result of the new inquiry came out and Lord Savile declared all those innocent, and our people innocent, David Cameron stood in the House of Commons in Westminster and apologised for what happened here. It was the first time ever in British-Irish relations that the British ever apologised for the actions of the security forces in Ireland. Never happened before. They've apologised since for the famine and other things, you know, but that was the first time ever that they ever apologised for what they did here in Ireland. That was vital. And to be truthful, the people are in shock when they heard it, because if you look at the footage on there, you'll see all the tears. That's the first time ever the British, Irish people have ever applauded the British Prime Minister. You'll never see that happen again either, you know. So it was something extreme, and it was a great outcome for us at that time. Really a great outcome for us at that time.
General Sir Michael Jackson, he was the commander of the 1st Battalion of the Parachute Regiment. He said, years later, he said, I believe that my men, the pilots, were innocent. He said, if I didn't believe that, I would have to think that they were dirty, murdering people, and I can't think that. I know, there are politicians now who are ex-British Army officers that will tell you, when you sit down and talk to them, that they can't believe it. They can't believe it, you know, because if they believe that, what must they believe of themselves and of the Army and the officer corps?
I am deeply patriotic. I never want to believe anything bad about our country. I never want to call into question the behaviour of our soldiers and our army, who I believe to be the finest in the world. Yeah. And I've seen for myself the very difficult and dangerous circumstances in which we ask our soldiers to serve. But the conclusions of this report are absolutely clear. There is no doubt, there is nothing equivocal. There are no ambiguities. What happened on Bloody Sunday was both unjustified and unjustifiable. It was wrong. Lord Savile concludes that the soldiers of the support company who went into the bogside did so as a result of an order which should not have been given by their commander. He finds that on balance, the first shot in the vicinity of the march was fired by the British Army. He finds that none of the casualties shot by the soldiers of support company was armed with a firearm. He finds that there was some firing by Republican paramilitaries, but none of this firing provided any justification for the shooting of civilian casualties. And he finds that in no case was any warning given by soldiers before opening fire. He also finds that support company reacted by losing their self-control, forgetting or ignoring their instructions and training, and with a serious and widespread loss of fire discipline. He finds that despite the contrary evidence given by the soldiers, none of them fired in response to attacks or threatened attacks by nail or petrol bombers. And he finds that many of the soldiers, and I quote, knowingly put forward false accounts in order to seek to justify their firing. What's more, Lord Saville says that some of those killed or injured were clearly fleeing or going to the assistance of others who were dying. The report refers to one person who was shot while crawling away from the soldiers. Another was shot, in all probability, when he was lying mortally wounded on the ground. And the report refers to the father, who was hit and injured by army gunfire after he had gone to tend to his son. For those looking for statements of innocence, Saville says, the immediate responsibility for the deaths and injuries on Bloody Sunday lies with those members of support company whose unjustifiable firing was the cause of those deaths and injuries. And crucially, that, and I quote, none of the casualties was posing a threat of causing death or serious injury, or indeed was doing anything else that could, on any view, justify their shooting. For those people who were looking for the report to use terms like murder and unlawful killing, I remind the House that these judgments are not matters for a tribunal or for us as politicians to determine. Mr. Speaker, these are shocking conclusions to read and shocking words to have to say. But, Mr. Speaker, you do not defend the British Army by defending the indefensible. We do not honour all those who've served with such distinction in keeping the peace and upholding the rule of law in Northern Ireland by hiding from the truth. So there is no point in trying to soften or equivocate what is in this report. It is clear from the Tribunal's authoritative conclusions that the events of Bloody Sunday were in no way justified. I know that some people wonder whether nearly 40 years on from an event, a Prime Minister needs to issue an apology. For someone of my generation, Bloody Sunday and the early 1970s are something we feel we have learnt about rather than lived through. But what happened should never, ever have happened. The families of those who died should not have had to live with the pain and the hurt of that day and with a lifetime of loss. Some members of our armed forces acted wrongly. The government is ultimately responsible for the conduct of the armed forces, and for that, on behalf of the government, indeed on behalf of our country, I am deeply sorry.
And for Cameron to say that, I know myself that the other families were joyous because their loved ones was cleared, but because myself and my father had always talked about wanted to go right to Ten Down Street, it was very, very disappointing that it didn't.
The outcome, of course, I have some comments to make on the outcome, because the outcome was a very limited and not entirely comprehensive of responsibilities. It didn't give an account of, didn't give accountability of those really responsible. It left London and the government and the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence and the big generals absolutely free, clean.
If there's any criticism of the Saville report or the Bloody Sunday report, it would be that it's heavy on innocence and light on guilt. So I think that's a legitimate criticism.
And it looks like we're never going to get justice for the loss of all our loved ones. And for all the attempt, and I can say it now, the unjustified and unjustifiable is about as nearly get the murderers as anybody's going to say, but they just didn't say, do you know what I mean? They just didn't say the word murder. But what's the difference? I mean, that's only a difference in wording, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Nobody gave them the order to come in. There was no specific order given, according to what they're saying. So in my mind, the British government's at fault. Always has been, so they should be culpable for the murders and attempted murders on Bloody Sunday if there was no official record of an order given. Whose decision was it?
Full truth hasn't been told. The Brits know it all. And they had to squeeze every little inch sort of truth out of them. slowly and slowly and slowly. And there are a lot of them still lying about it. They sort you talk to sort of retired army officers, as I would do now, sort of in a talk over the years, a lot of the unionist leaders who were around at the time, got to know some of them. And a lot of them are very decent people. Very decent people, sort of local politicians and so forth, but they just couldn't admit the truth of it. You know, you could show it to them, you could prove it to them. You know, you could take them to the corner where things happen. They just, their minds could not sort of assimilate or accept, you know, the truth of what had happened.
It's interesting, you know, that in recent years where, for the first time since 1969, that the prosecution authorities have started to turn their attention to soldiers and RUC personnel, that the British establishment, you know, given voice obviously by the current Tory government, is now looking to change the rules in respect of the possibility of further criminal charges and investigations and processes. And, you know, it for me, it clearly wasn't until I think the likes of Soldier F and our soldiers faced a realistic prospect of either being charged in a court of law or convicted in a court of law, that the British have decided that this is no good. This is a bad setup. This isn't fair to us, as in the British government, and that they would have to do something about it.
Not one soldier, not one politician, not one person has been brought and the courts prosecuted and either imprisoned or sentenced in whatever form for their actions on that day. So 50 years on, it's left me, and I know my family, we have absolutely no faith in the judicial system, even today. We think that the apology from David Cameron was more political than sincere.
I don't think that all the lessons have been learned from it, and I think that the political establishment, what I would call the ruling class, has any intention of drawing the appropriate lessons from Bloody Sunday. They don't. There are British Conservative politicians saying that these men are being unfairly put. The sense in which it's true. You know, there's lance corporals and privates now being asked to answer. They only did what they were expected to do. They did what they were ordered to do. Why aren't the people who gave them orders, why aren't they being asked? And it's, you know, like what Kipling called the poor bloody infantry. That's who always, you know, is asked to shoulder the guilt or any shame that's going around.
I wasn't concerned with the punishment, but I did want the prosecution, because I think we should be able to put in our loved ones' death certificate. We need to put the truth on there, not an open verdict. We need to put the truth on there. I would like my brother's death certificate to read, "Murdered by British Security Forces."
Us as the Bloody Sunday families, well, I don't think in my time ever see justice. I think it's quite unfair. And in our family, some of our children will carry it on, as I'm quite sure in some of the other families, they will carry it on to see if the British will right the right of the wrong that they done.
And I pray that my daddy's words sometimes will come true. He used to say, you know, as these boys get older, their conscience, they'll develop a conscience and they'll feel the need to tell the truth. And, you know, I still have that dream and that prayer that my daddy could be right in that 100%. Some of them soldiers, the ones, particularly the child Jackie, would have been near enough Jackie's age maybe, which would mean now that he would be approximately 67 years of age, 68. And that's not too old to grow a conscience and to finally maybe unburden himself and tell the truth about why it happened, why he did it, And why he felt the need to lie about it and cover it up. So in the meantime, as I say, please, 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 if you're out there and you're listening, that's all we've ever wanted. We never wanted revenge. We never wanted just to tell the truth about why Irwin was shot down like a street when he was running away and doing nothing and not guilty of anything.
I always said, always had a bad feeling these soldiers were all going to walk. They couldn't prosecute their armed forces no matter what anybody said. No. And that's the way it's been tumbling that way now since, you know what I mean? The only soldier now is getting charged now is Soldier F. He'll walk too, for sure.
There's a sadness and there's hope. I would want the death of my brother and the others in Bloody Sunday to have a value in the sense that they lost their lives, so many and so young. That's something good would result from that awful, awful, tragic, horrendous day. But the bullets, and I have no doubt about it, the bullets that killed my brother and the other victims of Bloody Sunday didn't stop on their bodies. They went three generations.
Hello, is there, this is 7-9. There are a lot of people, generally speaking, they are well-dressed people, Sunday afternoon walkers, either on their way to a meeting or perhaps just rubbernecking. Over.
This is 9-0 Alpha. Our call signs report the head of William Street block, head of the crowd at the William Street, Rossville Street junction. 6-5 from my Sunray, he would like to deploy one of his subunits through barrier 1-4 around the back into the area of William Street, Little James Street. He reckons if he does this, he'll be able to pick up quite a number of yobos, over. 0-0, this is 9-0 Alpha. A certain amount of stoning at serials 1-4 and 1-5. Neptune has been used at serial 1-4 with considerable effect, over.
Zero, this is 7-6. Two high-velocity shots heard in the area of the Rossville Flats. People are lying on the ground now. Over. Zero, this is 7-6. Apparently there is still a body lying just south of the Rossville Flats with some civilians around it. Over.
We shall overcome.
Thank you for listening. The aim of this project was to hear exactly what happened on that tragic day and to get a sense of those who had lost their lives. I hope this work will be a valuable archival piece for future generations. The family's fight for justice goes on.
My name is Damien Donaghy. I was 15 years of age when I was shot on Bloody Sunday by paratroopers.
My name is Charlie Glenn. I was a member of the Order of Malta Ambulance Corps in 1972, and I attended Jack Duddy after he was shot by members of the Parachute Regiment.
I'm Helen Deary. My mother's Peggy Deary, shot on Bloody Sunday, the paratroopers.
My name is Jimmy Duddy. I'm a nephew of Johnny Johnson, who was shot on Bloody Sunday.
My name's Jean Haggerty. I am the older sister of Kevin McElhinney, who died on Bloody Sunday.
My name is John Kelly. And I am the brother of Michael Kelly, one of those who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Eamon McCann. I was on the Bloody Sunday march.
My name is Kate McDade, the brother of Michael McDade, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Kate Nash. My brother William was shot dead on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Kate Duddy. I'm sister of Jackie Duddy.
My name's Liam Ray. My brother Jim was murdered by British paratroopers on January the 30th, 1972, what became known as Bloody Sunday.
My name's Leo Young, brother of John Young, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Rosalind Doyle, brother Kevin McElhinney was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Ursula Clifford. I was a nurse treating the dead and injured on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Mickey McKinney. I'm a brother of William McKinney, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Tony Doherty. My father was executed on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Bill Rukeyser. In 1972, I was a reporter-photographer working in Northern Ireland.